There was once a time when the ruler, the pharaoh, was simultaneously the high priest. In one and the same person, he was the earthly and spiritual leader of the people. Later, however, as the country grew greater through culture and wealth, the sons of God divided up the tasks, and ever since then one of them has fulfilled the duties of worldly government, while the eldest, the leader of the race, has been the spiritual leader of the people. The pharaoh rules the country. The high priest fulfills his duties in the temple. He is the guardian of knowledge in every field. Since all knowledge comes from a single source, it is he who gives the initiation into the sciences, into the arts, and also the great initiation in the temple into the artless art of the spirit. Now you know why the people we are ruling and teaching have differently shaped heads from those of the descendants of the sons of God who are now the reigning family. Those of us who have this elongated skull make relatively little use of our intellects because we are able to experience truth directly with our inner sight. Our forehead is not heavily arched, because in our heads the brain centers having to do with the power of thinking are only developed to the point necessary for us to perceive and consciously experience external impressions. On the contrary, in the rear part of our cranium we possess fully developed brain centers, the physical instruments of spiritual revelation. These brain centers enable us to be conscious on the divine plane and give us those superior qualities and characteristics which distinguish us from the sons of men. Human beings, in their consciousness, live in time and space. We, although we to inhabit earthly bodies, enjoy the perfect spiritual freedom, in freedom from time and space. Through the power of the divine consciousness and with the help of these brain centers, we are able to move freely in time and space. This means that we are able to shift our consciousness into the past or into the future at will. In other words, we are able to experience the past and the future as present. And with the same ease we can free ourselves from the hindrance of space and move our consciousness to any place we wish. In this condition there is no here and no there, but only omnipresence. For past and future, here and there, are only different aspects, different projections of the one and only reality, the eternal omnipresent being, God. The blood of both races is flowing in your veins. You inherited characteristics of our race, but also of the hybrid race from your mother's side. In you the higher organs are beginning to function, unfortunately much too early for you to have had time for earthly experiences or for you to have conquered your partially earthly nature. You are unsatisfied because you feel imprisoned in time and space, caught between here and there. The spirit within you is beginning to awaken and long for its divine freedom. You have asked three times to be initiated and you will be. Then you will learn to make conscious use of all the higher organs which are not yet fully active within yourself. You will also acquire the ability to establish contact at any time with similar beings in order to be able to exchange thoughts with them. I am thus able to establish spiritual contact at any time with my brother Tahotep or with any of the other descendants of the race of the sons of God still living on earth. Through a complete union of our consciousnesses, we are able to exchange our thoughts on any given subject much better than if we were talking together on the earthly plane with the help of larynx, tongue and ears. With our consciousness we can seek each other out at any time, but we feel immediately if the other is occupied and concentrating on something else. In such a case we disturb each other only if we have something very important to communicate, otherwise we withdraw. But you can easily understand why only persons who have achieved perfect unselfishness can have such abilities. If self-centered sons of men also had them, they would create such chaos that all the finer, higher organs would be ruined in the general confusion. For the most part we meet through uniting our consciousnesses in this way in the evening after our daily duties are done, and in this union we see each other's thoughts. Thus in a matter of moments we are able to agree on things which would take long discussion in a three-dimensional world. After we have thought over our worldly tasks, we shift over with our consciousness into the dimensionless state of all consciousness, in order to draw new vital energy from the eternal, divine, Original source. In this condition we are one with all living creatures, with the entire universe, identical with it in the divine, primordial union, one with life itself, with the eternal being, hence with the essence of every manifestation, with you too and with all other people. Only these beings who with their consciousness are still living in three dimensions are not aware of this union. On the other hand, every creature awakens from sleep with renewed vital energy, whether or not it knows that this energy comes from the divine original source. And so you are going to be initiated. This means you are starting on a long, long journey. You will have to travel this path on Earth even after Tahotep and I have left the three-dimensional world and only remain in spirit in the sphere of the Earth. I have different tasks from Tahotep. Your spiritual and intellectual guidance is in his hands. In the eternal union, however, we will always be together. It would have been better if you had had more patience. But you are as you are, and the way you are will also determine your fate and your future. We cannot interfere. The power which comes from union will always accompany you and help you through the most difficult times. Since you have the duty of representing the wife of the Pharaoh beside me, you will not be able to dwell in the temple as other neophytes do during the period of preparation for initiation. You will go there every morning for instruction. During the day, you will do your exercises there with the other neophytes and when evening comes you will return to the palace. At palace ceremonies you will come in time to fulfill your duties at my side. So you can report to Tahotep tomorrow morning. But I still have a question and so remain standing. Father looks at me quizzically. Father, I ask, you have told me that the sons of God, in order to propagate their spiritual powers, took wives from among the daughters of men. Didn't the daughters of the sons of God also take husbands from among the sons of men? Why have only the sons of God begotten children with the daughters of men? And not the daughters of God too with the sons of men? Father looks deep into my eyes and says, engrave this answer of mine upon the tablets of your memory. If you understand this truth really well, we may perhaps be able to set the rudder of your fate on a different course. If you pour out a drop from a glass of red wine into a glass of white wine, the red wine in the glass remains pure red wine as it was before. The white wine is no longer pure white wine, but a mixture of both. And if you then pour out some of the white wine, what you pour out is actually a mixture of red and white wine. Do you understand, my child? Yes, Father, I understand. You mean that the blood of a purebred son of God still remains pure if he begets children with a daughter of the sons of men. But the blood of the purebred daughter of God would become mixed blood if she were to marry one of the sons of men. From then on she would be mixed and so would her children. Remember this truth every moment of your life, says Father. Then he arises, I bow before him, and he blesses me. Preserving the unity of the soul in my heart, I leave the room. Years of preparation. Accompanied by Menu, I go to the temple. How often will I be going through this long colonnade between palace and temple? How often and for how many years! Until I myself have become the path, so that with my eyes closed my feet would carry me to the temple. Today I enter the temple for the first time as a neophyte. Just because I would like to hurry, I hold myself in check and walk with ceremonial slowness. I am determined to enjoy to the very last drop the pleasure of beginning my initiation. I am withdrawn within myself, deep in thought. Fully conscious of all the things my father told me yesterday, I go forward to my future duties as an initiate. At the entrance the same neophyte as before is awaiting me. Menu takes her leave. At first she embraces me, kisses me and holds me tight as if we were never to see each other again. Then she calms herself and bows before me in the way she believes she should. I embrace her and feel that my mother is also kissing me through Menu's lips. The neophyte accompanies me to Tahotep, who is waiting in his little reception room. How often, will I be standing thus before him? How often will his eyes rest upon me, or pierce me through and through with their peace, assurance and strength? My dear child, he begins, initiation, as I have already explained to you, means to become conscious on the highest level, the divine plane. To be able to do this requires long physical training and spiritual preparation. One first must strengthen the nerves to enable them to bear these high vibrations without harm, without death. To become conscious on a given plane means to conduct the vibrations characteristic of this plane into the nerves and through the nerves into the body. From the time a body is born, that is, from the time a self dwells in it, the body develops a power of resistance corresponding to the average degree of consciousness of the spirit dwelling in it. The degree of consciousness of a living creature fluctuates up and down, depending on its emotional condition, within the limits of an octave of vibrations. These fluctuations, however, must not exceed the limits of elasticity of the nerves, for if they do, injuries and sicknesses of a more or less serious nature occur, even death. The vibration belonging to creative vital energy is absolutely lethal for creatures whose consciousness has not yet reached this level. It would burn out the nerves and nervous centers. For this reason, vital energy from the spinal column, where it has its seat, is transformed into a low vibration corresponding to the degree of consciousness of the person concerned, and only this transformed vital current is conducted into the body. Thus animals, for example, are animated by a much lower life vibration than primitive man, and primitive man with his beast-like selfish nature, is animated by lower vibrations of vital energy than a person who is spiritually developed. If one were to conduct the vital energy of a highly developed human being into an animal or a much less developed human, the animal or lower level human would die instantly because of the contact with the more powerful vibrations. The great initiation means consciously experiencing the vital energy and creative vibrations of eternal being, experiencing these vibrations on every plane of development and in their original frequency, without transformation, and simultaneously conducting these vibrations into the nerves and the body. This naturally requires a corresponding amount of resistance, which can be obtained through physical and spiritual training. That means that one must slowly and cautiously prepare and awaken the appropriate nerve centers and learn to control them. Initially, you will receive this physical and spiritual training from Mentupta, the leader at the school of neophytes. In your concentration exercises, Ima, and Tahotep points to the neophyte who brought me here, will help you. When you have passed your preparatory tests given you by Mentupta and Ima, you will receive further training and your initiation under my guidance. Now Ima will take you to the neophyte school and give you everything you need for the beginning. If you want to speak to me during your training, you can arrange to see me any evening. May God guide your further steps. After Tahotep's benediction, I bow and follow Ima to the school of neophytes. Ima takes me to a little cell, one of many built in the temple wall. He gives me a plain white linen robe and a pair of plain sandals, saying that this cell belongs to me. When I come out, having exchanged my silken robe and golden sandals for the simple clothing, I am a neophyte exactly like Ima. He leads me on through a long colonnade, and through the great door we step out into the temple garden. The garden is magnificent. A large rectangular plot of green grass bordered by palms makes an excellent place for exercise. As we go on, I see the neophytes at work behind the park-like part of the garden, near the vegetable plots and the orchards. All the neophytes wear the same kind of clothing as mine, but none of them is as young as I. Ima takes me to Mentupta, the head of the school of neophytes. He is a friendly person with soft, loving eyes. He explains my daily duties to me. The neophytes are divided up in groups. All groups are under Mentupta's guidance, but each individual group also works under the leadership of an advanced neophyte, a candidate for priesthood. Ima leads the group to which I am assigned. He is a tall, slender but very powerful young man. I noticed his crystal pure radiance when he first took me to Tahotep. He has passed most of his preparatory tests and the time is close at hand for him to be initiated. Ima is a candidate for the priesthood. In his appearance he doesn't give the impression of a man so much as of an androgynous being standing above and beyond sex. As much above and beyond it as an archangel. He radiates all the keenness of a sharp sword. His angelically beautiful face bears the signs of supreme intelligence and powers of concentration. Above his eyebrows there are two well-developed mounds, the signs of wisdom. His mouth is well-formed, beautiful, full of energy, but with soft corners, delicately chiseled, revealing his tender love for every living creature. I love him from the very first moment, feeling complete confidence in him as I would in a dearly beloved brother. I am happy that he is the one who is to prepare me for my tests. Amma introduces me to the other neophytes. They have all chosen the priesthood as their calling in life, but only those who pass all their tests and receive initiation will become priests or priestesses. There are many who never make it. Nevertheless, if they wish to do so, they can spend the rest of their lives in the service of the temple, working in the garden and tending the animals. The neophytes who pass their preparatory examinations receive ever new and progressively more difficult tasks and assignments parallel with their degree of advancement. The group under Ima's guidance is one made up entirely of spiritually well-developed neophytes. On their father's side, most of them are descended from the sons of God, just as I am, and they can be recognized even from a distance by the elongated shape of their heads. I am assigned to this group and feel good in their pure atmosphere. Every morning at sunrise we have to assemble in the garden. We begin with physical exercises. The exercises involve strong concentration. We assume various body postures and, while doing breathing exercises, must guide our consciousness into different parts of the body. Through long and patient practice in this way we can make the entire body completely conscious. Move at will, control and guide the smallest parts of the body and all internal organs. Patiently and persistently we thus develop the body into an excellent instrument. When we have finished these exercises, we go into the great room of the temple for training of mind and soul. In these exercises, Mantapta dictates to us various interrelated dream pictures which we must experience as intensively as if they were real. With these dream pictures we intentionally produce different emotional states within ourselves and learn how to control them. With these exercises Mantapta takes us through all the different spheres of the underworld and overworld, through the seven hells and the seven heavens, teaching us to keep our presence of mind no matter what may happen so that even in the most difficult situations we can instantly decide what to do. As soon as we have completely mastered this kind of exercise, we go a step further. We have to experience different emotional states on command, without dream pictures, but with the same intensity as if we really had a reason. We begin these exercises at the lowest negative condition, moving up step by step until we reach the highest positive condition. To take an example, we begin by experiencing the deepest state of dejection, moving up gradually through indifference, then on higher and higher, through joy and on up to the highest state of happiness. When after long practice we get proficient at this exercise, we are obliged to practice faster changeovers from one emotional state to another until we can experience them all, one after the other, as easily and positively as a musician draws forth a whole gamut of tone from his instrument, from the lowest to the highest. When we achieve proficiency at running quickly through the whole scale of human emotions, from darkest desperation to the highest bliss, we take the next step. This consists of experiencing opposite emotional states, one after the other, with no time lost for transition, shifting from deep sadness immediately to the highest hilarity. Or, to take another example, from fear immediately to self-assured courage. We are only permitted to do these exercises under the direction of our teacher. They represent a great strain for our nerves. It takes us a long time to reach the point of being able, with the aid of the dream pictures, to experience the emotional states as vividly as if they were external events in our lives. It takes us still longer to be able to experience the full scale of emotional states from the lowest to the highest. Only when we can bring our nerves to complete rest after these exercises, keeping them in a well-rested condition throughout the day, are we permitted to practice the most difficult exercises of experiencing diametrically opposite emotions without a time of transition. The aim of these exercises is to make us independent of both external events and our own personal moods, thus enabling us to determine our own moods ourselves and maintain our emotional equilibrium no matter what happens. We are taught constant inner watchfulness and presence of mind. People believe that there always has to be a reason for their being joyous or happy. Through the exercises with the dream pictures, we first imagine we have a reason for being in one mood or another. Thus we learn to control the reasons themselves. As we do not actually have a reason, however, we have to imagine one ourselves. Then comes the next step of experiencing an emotional state by itself, without a reason, without having previously imagined a situation such as would call forth the mood to be experienced. After long practice, when we have become quite skillful at these exercises, we discover we have always imagined we had a reason for being sad or joyous, depressed or exuberant, etc. Through these exercises, we thus become convinced that events and occurrences in our lives must not have any effect on us. We discover that every state of consciousness arises, and can only arise, within ourselves. One and the same event can provoke one person to laughter, another to tears, while a third remains completely indifferent, all because each is merely projecting outwardly his own inward attitude, and it is only this inward attitude which provokes our response, not the external events themselves. As a final result, the pupil must attain the ability to keep his emotional composure imperturbable and unshakable at all times, never losing it under any circumstances. These exercises also teach us that whatever happens on earth is only a transitory dream picture projected in time and space by ourselves. We only need to take it seriously insofar as it adds to our experience. But it takes a long, long time to reach this degree of ability. We have to keep ourselves under the strictest observation, must never forget ourselves for a moment, must always be conscious and aware, always analyzing every feeling, every thought, to determine in what stratum of the self it has originated. And all this is not something one can learn to do from one day to the next. In addition to this long spiritual training, we also have to practice purely mental concentration exercises. These are assigned to me by Amma. After the group exercises, he takes me to a quiet corner of the garden and explains what concentration means. I must not allow my thoughts to roam around aimlessly. On the contrary, I must command myself to concentrate only on one prescribed concept. I must pull my thoughts together into a single point, giving them a centripetal rather than centrifugal direction. Amma gives me a sentence on which to concentrate. When I have succeeded in concentrating on it, I am to go and tell him. Then he leaves me alone. The sentence is, "I always manifest divinity." I sit down and start to concentrate on this sentence. I repeat mentally, "I always manifest divinity," once, twice, 10 times, 100 times. I think of nothing else. "I always manifest divinity. I always manifest divinity. I always manifest divinity." After an hour, I go to Amma and tell him, "I can't concentrate on that sentence. It's impossible." "Impossible?" he asks. "Why should it be impossible? You told me that concentration means directing all forces, all thoughts to a single point, drawing and holding together all the forces of the intellect and of consciousness. But when I concentrate on a sentence, I cannot draw together all the forces of my intellect into one single point. A sentence consists of several words. These words follow each other both in time and space. That means I can't simultaneously think these words in a given point, but only one after another in time and space. And when I have thought the sentence through to the end, I have to jump back again to the beginning and think it through to the end again. That's why concentration in this way is impossible. Either I have to jump back from the end to the beginning after each sentence, like this, or, if I imagine a sentence in a circular form, My concentration results in running around in a circle, but that is not concentration. Ima listens attentively. Then, quite pleased, he says, "You have practiced right. You've discovered it's impossible to concentrate on words. The fact that you finally imagined the words to be in the form of a circle shows that you were making a real effort at concentration. But no matter how close you pull the words together, they still form a circle and you can never get them into the center. You have found out that no matter how much force you exert on them in the direction of the center, the words resist this force so you cannot draw them into the center. This principle of resistance towards being drawn into the center is one we use in building bridges. We build an arch of stones, just as you have built a circle out of words, and the bridge doesn't fall into the water because the stones exert pressure on each other and the stones do not yield to the pressure. Because of the power of their resistance, the stones hold the whole bridge together. But if your concentration aims to get to the center, it is prevented from doing so by the resistance of the words, and the concentration is impossible. The same happens if you try to concentrate on one word. A word consists of letters which can never be drawn together completely in a single point. So what must I do? For your next exercise, try to concentrate on a single letter. Take the letter O, for example, says Ima, and leaves me alone. I try it. Sitting in the grass again, I concentrate on the O. Mentally I repeat the letter O, saying O, 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 O. And still thinking of nothing but O, O, V, O, 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 O. Until all of a sudden I make a new discovery. I go back to Ima and tell him laughingly, "I've already finished." "Well," he asks, "what have you found out?" "That the O I was concentrating on all of a sudden turned into a pipe. A long O-shaped tunnel in which I was constantly moving forward. But that isn't perfect concentration either." "Good," says Ima. "That means you've already reached the fourth dimension. Now try again with the sentence 'I always manifest divinity' and try again to concentrate on that. How would you solve the problem now?" "What should I do?" I ask. "What would you do?" asks Ima in his turn. I consider the problem for a while and then say, "The words are the clothing, the material manifestation of the meaning. If I want to get into the center, I must give up the words that hinder me and concentrate only on the meaning of the sentence, without words, without form. Is that right?" Ima smiles and says, "Let's see how you succeed. Go and try. Then come back." I go back and concentrate on the meaning of the sentence "I always manifest divinity." Apostrophe. Only on the meaning. Then I go back to Ima. He is just finishing a discussion with another neophyte. Seeing that I am waiting for him, he gives me a roguish glance as if he already knew how I had got on with my concentration exercise. "Well?" he asks. "Ima, it's so strange. As I tried to concentrate only on the meaning of the sentence, I couldn't think of it anymore, and the whole inner process moved out of my head into my breast, so that I wasn't thinking it anymore, but feeling and experiencing it. The moment I concentrated on the meaning of this sentence, without words, I myself became this meaning. But then the sentence has to read differently, not 'I always manifest divinity,' but much more accurately, 'I am divinity which is always manifesting itself.'" As I speak, Ima looks at me with a growing smile and growing pleasure. "You have concentrated very well," he says. "Very well. You've discovered that concentration cannot be a permanent condition, but only a transition between the projected world and being. When you concentrate your thoughts on something, you can't stop with just thinking, because concentration leads you back to yourself, and you become the very thing you're concentrating on. From thinking you progress through concentration into a state of being. Thinking ceases completely and the thinker becomes identical with what he is thinking. To think something means to project a thought outwardly by means of the intellect, as if by means of a mirror, hence to step out of oneself. Through concentration we draw the projection back again, and what is thought becomes identical again with the thinker, with the person himself. the two factors are joined in a perfect unity. That which is created goes back into the Creator. Go on practicing and you will experience this process with ever greater clarity. Here's a new exercise. You like to sit under this palm tree. Concentrate on it.